Charter School Subcommittee Group for the Minnesota Senate on Thursday, December 17th, 2009. Welcome to our committee members, and I appreciate that we're making you work during the interim at a very important topic. And today, if you see your agenda in front of you, some of the issues that have been suggested to us deal with our conflict of interest laws. And this was an area that we did some work this past session, but I'd really like to dive into that because I know the legislative auditor has noted that, but there's also been reported incidents where we've heard people have asked, isn't this a conflict of interest? So we want to really understand that. I know we are not the Judiciary Committee, so I think having some background will be helpful for us. So I appreciate having the legislative auditor's office here today and then our own staff. I've also asked the department if they will give us an update on the compliance issues with the legislation passed in 2009 and also give us an update on some of the reporting that we heard in October. I believe we received some mixed information, so we do want to clarify that. To have the Charter School Association here to respond, because we really have not heard from them yet. And then I'd like to, after we've heard all of this, go back to some discussion of, again, what are some of the issues that we want to dive into? I think I gave you some examples. But also, is there additional information that you would like presentations, more additional background for us? And the one thing I did ask the department to do, and they just do not have today, and we didn't expect them to have that, was we asked them to look into what are the actual financing costs for some of the affiliated building corporations, because I know that we've seen that sometimes the actual building itself may be more competitive in its actual cost, but with some of the higher interest financing, what is the real cost in terms of taxpayers? So we are going to be looking at that probably in January. We might have two more meetings in January. We'll be talking about that a little bit at the end. So I really, again, appreciate that you're interested and you're here today. So we'll get started. So any other comments from the committee before we get started or questions? All right, we have 9 o'clock. We're ready to go. So would Ms. Randall come forward, please? And again, thank you for coming. And I believe in your packets, you should have both the 2003, the June 2003, and the June 2008, these sections of their report. One of them has to do in 2003 with some of the questions they raised about affiliated building corporations. And then in June 2008, there was in their report, it did talk about the conflict of interest. So I have both of those in front of us today. So there you go. So Ms. Randall, thank you again for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Thanks for inviting me to speak today. Senator Saltzman had asked me to talk about conflict of interest laws and the recommendations and findings we had in our 2008 report. So let me just talk briefly, just why do we have conflict of interest laws? Well, the idea is that the board, the charter school board, is making decisions that are in the best interest of the charter school and not decisions that are in the best interest of the individual, so that they aren't benefiting or profiting individually. It's, again, to have the best interest of the charter school at heart there. So in our evaluation, I also provided in your packets, there's just a one-page copy. It's from page 54 of the 2008 report, and it shows there a table just showing potential conflicts of interest for charter school boards and then the laws that applied at the time. And basically, there were three sets of conflict of interest laws that applied to charter school boards. There was specific charter school conflict of interest laws in state law. There's federal conflict of interest law that applies when the charter school receives federal funds, which typically is at least the first 3 years when the charter school receives federal startup funds. And then also under, again, this is previous to the changes you all made last year, school district law that applies generally to school districts had conflict of interest provisions that also applied to charter school boards. So the table 3.3 on page 54, kind of steps through some of the instances when a potential conflict of interest could exist and what the different laws said about those situations. And really our main finding here was that the different laws that applied were at odds with each other. So the laws themselves, the conflict of interest laws themselves conflicted. And so our main recommendation was to kind of get them all in line. And we recommended that the legislature follow the federal conflict of interest laws, which were the most strict standard. So I'll walk through each of those scenarios that are laid out there in the table. So the first situation is if the charter school board member is also an employee of a for-profit organization with which the charter school contracts. And all three laws that applied to charter schools back in 2008 said, yeah, that's a conflict of interest. However, if the board member is an employee of a nonprofit organization, state law said, no, that's okay, just disclose that relationship to the department, but it's okay. And you can see there that the federal law said, no, that's still not okay. So federal law didn't make a distinction if you were an employee between a for-profit and a nonprofit organization, whereas the state law at the time did. And then the third row there on the table is if the board member's immediate family provided contracted services. Again, federal law said, no, that's a conflict, whereas state law was silent on that. And then we also had some issues regarding potential conflicts of interest with the sponsor, that was the language at the time, now authorizer. So in the 2009 session, you all approved a bunch of changes to the conflict of interest law. And I believe you have a copy of the law in your packet. Subdivision 4A in particular outlines the conflict of interest laws that are now in place. And let me just highlight kind of some of the changes that you all made. So the main one, in following our recommendations, first you added in that either if they're an employee of a for-profit or a nonprofit organization, that's now a conflict of interest. So you added in the nonprofit organization classification to be in line with the federal law. And then you also identified a number of types of relationships that would also not be acceptable, that would also be considered a conflict of interest. So now it's not just the board member, but as you can see, let's see, 4A paragraph B, where you can see 1, 2, 3, 4 down lines 13 through 16, listing immediate family members of the board member, partners, et cetera. So there's more of the relationships that are also kind of captured in the conflict of interest law. So those were the changes that were made. And, you know, our recommendation was to kind of bring all of those things under the cloak and have them be also considered conflicts of interest.
Very good question. For Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've always kind of puzzled about this, and I don't know that it isn't reflected in these options, but has there ever been a concern of conflict of interest of the fact that we had a majority of the board were actually employees of the entity that they were governing?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, well, yeah, and that was another recommendation that we had. I didn't reflect on that, but if you do have a copy of the report with you on page 55, then we talk about the teacher majority on the school board and how we think that sets up a conflict, because we talked about it as if it sets up circular oversight is kind of the language we use, saying, all right, so the teachers are overseeing the director of the school when they're on the board, but then during the day the director's overseeing the teachers when they're teachers, and it was very circular. So we had a recommendation to the legislature in the 08 report to remove the requirement that teachers comprise the majority. And last year you all did make a change to that. I don't know that it's in the – I don't think it's in the statutes that you have printed
right
out there. But basically now it says that I think one teacher needs to be on the board, but there's no longer a requirement that there's a majority. There can be a majority. I don't think the law prohibits it, but it's not required any longer.
Yeah.
But
that's
I don't
a good
know if
point.
Somebody else
– right.
Is that right? Okay. I'm getting confirmation on that, yeah.
And that's why we included that in this section here, because it did address some other oversight issues. So I know that when the report was done on the affiliated building corporations, would you be able to comment, Ms. Randall, in the fact that there's been arguments made that these affiliated building corporations are oftentimes made up entirely of members of the charter school board or several of them or at least one, and under the new statute that would not be permissible. Is that something in terms of oversight? Because I know that you didn't address that specifically, but if you had looked at that a little more closely, would that have been a concern? I know that at the time when you did it was more like that there were concerns that it was a loophole, but perhaps comment on that.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, you know, as you've noted, we didn't look directly at that, so I'm starting down the path of speculation, which is always a nervous part for the auditor. But trying to think about what I can say and feel comfortable with. Here's one comment. Charter schools are generally organized as nonprofits, either cooperatives or nonprofits. And one thing we talked about kind of in relation to the teacher majority aspect is that when we talked with the Council of Nonprofits, they have kind of guidelines out there for representation and conflicts. And they said, you know, no more than one employee should be on the board. And so that's kind of what leaps to mind, I guess, when you ask the question is, you know, should there be absolutely none? I mean, I think things need to be disclosed. For sure. You know, any type of relationship needs to be disclosed. I guess I don't feel equipped at this point to pass a judgment either way. I believe Ms. McQuay is going to touch a little bit on the Affiliated Building Court and conflict of interest, not to put her in the hot seat. So perhaps that discussion can evolve.
You know, on the comment you made about the circular oversight is very interesting because, again, I guess I would suggest that in hearing just your testimony today that there is a concern of why we have conflict of interest laws are to make sure that there is transparency, that people are watching out for different interests. And if you are the landlord versus, you know, the person who is leasing the property, are you looking out for the best interests of everyone? So that might be, I think I like the term circular oversight, that we don't want circular oversight, that we do have different people looking out for the best interests of each group.
Madam Chair, yes. And I would just add, I think as I stated in the beginning, that the idea is that the board is looking out for the best interest of the organization, and that they need to have that as their focus when they're acting as the board. And so if they have other roles, you know, whether it's a teacher or whether it's as the building owner or whether it's as whatever, you know, that they may then have competing interests, I guess. And so the idea of conflict of interest laws is to mitigate those and to lessen them to the extent possible.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Ms. Randall? From the committee. Thank you very much. So, Dr. McQuay and Ms. Junker, if you would like to lead us to, I think we have another handout here that you've prepared to. I had asked if you would look at some of the charter school conflict of interest, particularly with the affiliated nonprofit building corporations, and just walk us through that again. So,
Madam Chair, members, I think you just had the handout passed out. So on the top, it says charter school conflicts of interest. What I'll do is basically walk you through the new law, the current law on the conflict, and kind of what falls under that conflict of interest statute. So basically it's kind of a series of questions, and you can see. So the first is just whether it's a contract for professional services, goods or facilities. If that's the case, then it starts bringing you under that 124D10 subdivision 4A, the conflict of interest. And then the next question you need to ask is whether it's a contract between the charter school and an entity, either nonprofit or for-profit, or is it with an individual person? The language specifically says entity. So if it is a contract with an individual person, it doesn't fall under the conflict of interest. So you have to make sure that it's notice whether it's a contract with an entity, whether it's nonprofit or for-profit. And then the final question for that that sort of conflict is this: is a member of the charter school board or the member's immediate family member or partner an owner, employee, agent of, or contractor with the entity that the charter school is contracting with? And if that is the case, and you've met all three of those tests, whether the first two questions and that question, then you do have a conflict under that paragraph A of that subdivision. And if so, then the board member cannot remain on the charter school board, and if they're going to proceed with the contract. Otherwise, they just don't proceed with the contract. And if there is a violation, that board member is actually individually liable to the charter school for any damage that's caused by the violation of the conflict of interest. And then there's a second sort of conflict of interest that comes under subdivision 4A, and that's dealing with if they're going to supervise or select or award or administer a contract. So then there's three questions to ask, and if you answer yes to any one of those questions, then you have a paragraph or a conflict under paragraph B. So you look at whether a member of the charter school board or the member's immediate family member, partner, or employer has a financial or other interest in an entity with whom the charter school would be contracting, or does an employee of the charter school or the immediate family member, partner, or employer of an employee of the charter have a financial or other interest in that entity? And then finally, does an officer or agent of the charter school or an immediate family member, partner, or employer of the officer or agent of the charter have a financial or other interest in that entity? And again, you know, if you do answer yes to any one of those, that the charter school, if they proceed with the contract, the effective board member, employee, officer, or agent or of the charter is actually prohibited from doing any of the selecting, awarding, or administering the contract. And also the commissioner has the authority to void the contract, or another individual may sue to void the contract. So they, it's better if they do continue with the contract that the charter school board, you know, in their minutes or in some way just reflect that the that affected member is not involved in the selecting, awarding, or administering of that contract they're going ahead with.
Madam Chair, it seems that the biggest tie-in to for the conflict of interest language in Subdivision 4 to affiliated nonprofit building corporations would be on page 1, line 17, has a financial or other interest in the entity. And I, it may be a little too subjective to say that a nonprofit has a financial interest in the entity, and does a nonprofit have a financial interest? And that may be something that the committee would like to further clarify and is subject to interpretation. Also, the nonprofit building corporation language seems to bump up against IRS code. And if you look at the handout that Ms. Yunker was going over on the bottom of that page, there are three types of supporting organizations that IRS code categorizes, and those are type 1, type 2, and type 3. The first is type 1 is an operated, supervised, or controlled by the supported organization. In this case, the supported organization would be the charter school. This is a type of parent-subsidiary relationship where the supported organization elects or appoints the majority. A type 2 is more of a brother-sister relationship where it's supervised or controlled in connection with the charter school, and the same persons would sit seemingly on the board of the charter school and the supporting organization. And then a type 3 is operated in cooperation with, and this is the type 3s are not currently recommended by the IRS and are slow, if ever, to get approved by the IRS. So most, but not all, this is very generally speaking, affiliated nonprofits can be categorized as a type 1 or type 2. And if you'll notice in the type 1 classification, the supported or the charter school then would elect or appoint a majority, and neither the type 1 does not say that the same board members would sit. It doesn't dictate the number of membership overlap, whereas type 2 would do that to a certain extent. Again, it would be a simple tie-in to IRS code with Minnesota statute if we could say that all affiliated nonprofit building corporations fell into one of these. I don't think that we're going to find that the case, and maybe the department has more information on that. And then if there's no questions on that, I think Ms. Yunker and I have gone through and just pointed out a couple of places in the law that could be addressed.
Great. Why don't we go through those? That would be helpful.
Ms. Yunker mentioned on page 1, line 5, the entity should probably be clarified to mean entity or individual. Entity in this situation does not include individual, and it would probably be good clarification to do so in there. On page 1, line 18, there's a sentence there that says a violation of this prohibition renders the contract void. The committee could look into assigning who would void the contract. Would it be the authorizer, the board, or the commissioner? I think that would be a relevant thing for the committee to look into. And then as far as the affiliated nonprofit building building corporation language goes, and that begins on the top of page 2, the language in the subdivision 17A just starts off with allowing a charter school to organize an affiliated nonprofit building corporation, but nowhere does the statute really define what the affiliated nonprofit building corporation is. The problem with going maybe too prescriptive in a definition is that it is too prescriptive, but that's something that the committee could maybe consider doing. In addition, the statute may not cover those charter schools that use the national affiliated or a national nonprofit building corporations. That's something that maybe the committee could direct staff to look into. There may be some incentive for charter schools to use national building corporations instead of establishing their own. Also, one other thing for the committee to consider, and this is just something that has come up in looking through this, is nonprofit law, according to Minnesota statute in 317A735, requires that upon dissolution of a nonprofit, that the remainder of the assets be held for or devoted to a charitable or public purpose. In many circumstances, or I guess not many, because I don't know that this situation has come up yet, we're still several years away from nonprofit building corporations paying off their mortgage. But if the situation were to arise that a building corporation went into default, they would most likely pay off their creditors first. And would there be any assets left? Maybe not necessarily. But in the cases that there are remainder of assets, they would have to be dedicated to a charitable or public use. And the committee could consider, as long as we are within IRS code, to better define that public, what that public use is. And then finally, under paragraph, this would be on page 3, line 6, a positive review and comment from the commissioner under section 123B71. This is a requirement now of charter school buildings to follow the same procedures that a school district would follow in building a building. And I think the intention of adding this was that it is a school and they should follow the same procedures, but the committee should probably consider that this may also be another reason for charter schools to look at maybe a nonprofit building, a national nonprofit building corporation, or a way to not abide by this law, because it is a cumbersome procedure. There's several pieces of information required that could potentially add to the cost of a charter school building. Much of the argument in charter school buildings is that they do follow building code, and they just don't follow the school building code. And we've added things like to include when you're proposing a construction facility is to do provide a description of pedestrian, bicycle, and transit connections, a specification of how the project maximizes opportunity for cooperative use of existing park, recreation, and other public facilities. There's a list of about of 16 pieces of information that are required that if the board decided that these factors were important that maybe they wouldn't have looked at before, it could increase the cost of the charter school building.
So on that point, though, we could also then argue that why do we have these for other public school buildings? I mean, you know, it could be if there's a reason for this, should we look at some of those, maybe not all of them, but some of them could be considered why we think they're important, and are they important enough that all public schools should have to? I guess I raise that for the committee to think about. it could be an all or nothing sort of piece as well. It's very helpful, Ms. Quay. And where can we find the information that is required for the review and comment? What section of statute is that?
Madam Chair, it's the requirement in charter school law is that charter school building need a positive review and comment under section 123B71.
Very good.
I think also to clarify this even further, we might want to add it into the section of law. There's I believe it's subdivision 8 that says state, local, and federal requirements. We may want to cross-reference it there to ensure that the charter schools, that is one of the laws that charter schools have to follow.
Okay.
And then finally, under in paragraph 3, subdivision 4 of the revenue of a charter school, building lease aid, I think one of the things that the committee has discussed and that this would probably be the best place for that is the concept of changing the lease aid when a building is paid off. We give the commissioner 3 criteria to look at to approve or deny a lease. The reasonableness of the price, the extent to which the lease conforms to applicable state laws, and the appropriateness of the proposed lease in the context of the space needs and financial circumstances of the school district. This may be a place where we want to consider adding something about if the building is paying off, whether the charter school is paying for the actual upkeep of a building or the building, the paying off of a building.
Very good. Are there any other questions for Dr. McQuay? You know, one thing I would like to note that I think when we look at this in more depth is that it's my understanding that all public school projects as defined in statute with these, and this would not include these buildings under affiliated building corporations, that the Department of Labor and Industry is responsible for construction code plan review and inspections. And that sometimes the department can sign an agreement with a municipal or local inspection department to do that. And it may be interesting to look at, is that something where, again, we require this of district schools? Should we or should we not? I just put it on the table. I'm not suggesting we do or we don't. But look at, should Dolly be involved with that? Also, the state fire marshal inspects all public school buildings and charter school buildings through a contract with MDE, I understand. And when are those inspections taking place? Should they take place before the building is finished or renovated? Because I've heard some situations where maybe the department comes in, the fire marshal comes in after the building's done, and if it's out of compliance with code, it's costing more to then renovate or put these specific codes in place. So I guess I'd like to look at code compliance and plan review as well. And I think the issue would be not just oversight, but basically is there a cost factor there if we do it in advance versus trying to renovate afterwards or trying to make changes. So I have asked the Department of Labor and Industry to perhaps just give us an update on that at a future meeting. So. All right. Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just for a point of consistency, in one of your earlier comments, Dr. McQuay, on line 18, on rendering the contract void, in public school situations, is that typically the commissioner? I mean, if we were going to get specific about who would make that decision, is that?
Madam Chair and Senator Scogin, throughout the rest of the language, we have pointed to, if you look at line 7, a violation of this prohibition renders a contract voidable at the option of the commissioner or the charter school board of directors. Throughout the charter school language, we've at different points given it to the authorizer, to the board, and to the commissioner. So there's a little bit of inconsistency throughout.
It
to somebody.
Maybe narrow that down.
Yes, we want you to Senator Scogin. Very good idea. So.
Madam Chair.
Good. And Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Dr. McQuay, and I thought that was an excellent report with the recommendations, both of you.
Shocker.
I'm wondering, first, you can obviously put together a draft that we can vet for the upcoming session. But there's also the reference to the IRS, and that you may need to contact them, and getting a response and formalizing some dialogue does have, may not have the same timeline we would have. So have you initiated any discussions, you know, with them just for potential policy guidance on this to the extent it would be helpful?
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, we put this on the table as something that the committee could consider looking into, and I guess I would feel more comfortable waiting for direction from the committee.
So we may want to give you that. And I think, too, that in looking at this, this is not to say that we need to have all these policies in place, because the decision may be, do we need affiliated building corporations? Is there another way of doing this? I mean, that's the other issue, is with all of these other issues going on, is there a better way to provide charter school facilities? So I think having this background illustrates, you know, the all the complexities of these corporations. And technically, we go back to, I think, the 2003 Legislative Auditors Report, and there it states that these were created to go around the law. So if we fix the law, is there a better way of doing this? So I just put that out there, and I think that if we all are open-minded, but I appreciate that, Senator Wieger, because I think that goes to, are we making a system that is just way too complex when there's an easier way to do this? So... okay, very good. With that, do you have anything else, Dr. McQuay, or any? Very good. The department is here, the Department of Education, and I did ask them to give us an update from our October report that they gave to the department. And we're particularly... would like to hear that in our 2009 legislation, when we did add the language that acknowledged affiliated building corporations, the point of that was to begin to collect data and be able to consider some of the oversight, and some of that required reporting. And so it would be helpful to have that, and just a sense from the department of, have there been any issues, concerns, are there some things, you know, particularly related to this that we should address, or if you have suggestions for, or we're open for that discussion in the future. So, Dr. Melcher.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher with the Minnesota Department of Education. I provided you with an updated copy of the work that we have done with charter schools that have affiliated building corporations, and the status of the data collection that we have from them. We had a hearing on October 8th where we were early in the process of collecting the data. We did learn after the October 8th hearing that there were some inaccuracies in the initial report that we produced. We had initially identified 28 charter schools that we thought had affiliated building companies. In early October, we had received the information from 7 of them. Currently, we have received complete information from 21 of the 29. So, almost all of the charter schools have been very good about getting back to us once it was clearly understood what we were looking for, and have provided the information to us. We have 3 that we're still trying to get a few pieces of the data from, and there are 4 that are disputing the classification as an affiliated building corporation. There's a little bit of ambiguity in the law as to what exactly an affiliated building corporation is, and there are all these different models out there which make it a little bit confusing to kind of get a real grasp on, and it may be an area where we might need to go back and look at some clarifying language in law to see exactly what we're talking about here.
So for those 4, Dr. Melcher, are those 4 listed on this sheet?
Yes. If the first page here is just a summary sheet of the information, and the second page is the actual listing of the schools. Mr. Hine here has done most of the work in terms of contacting these directly, and he may need to jump in here. But if you look on the second sheet, you'll see a list of the 29 schools that we have been we've been looking at and the kinds of information that we've requested, which includes the proof of incorporation, copies of their IRS forms, a list of the building corporation board members, proof of building ownership, a copy of the building's annual audit, or a statement that they're considered a component unit of the charter school. And what you can see here in the left-hand column, we have kind of a code here, which the ones that are listed as a D, which includes the Aurora School, the Birch Grove Community School, the Great Expectations, and then Natawash are the four that are in this kind of status where they're disputing whether, in fact, they meet the definition of a building affiliated building corporation.
So could you explain, Dr. Melcher, what you perceive their, how are they organized now? There must be something that is causing the department to even question if they are. It's because do they have some sort of organization that owns the facility that you believe might have an affiliation with the charter school board?
Madam Chair, I wonder if I could ask Mr. Hine to comment on that. He's done the detailed work on this.
Thank you, Dr. Hine. Mr. Hines.
Thank you. There's just a variety of different kind of structures out there. I would take like Birch Grove as an example. The Birch Grove Community Foundation is the nonprofit lessor in that circumstance, but that entity was formed, I believe, back in like 1985. And they run the community center and a daycare center. So they were in existence long before the school came along. It just, I guess for convenience sake, happened to be the chosen entity to become the building lessor so that they could transact and run the building through that organization. So it wasn't like a lot of these are clean, that you can tell that the building corp was formed exclusively and solely for that purpose. Some of these entities have other activities other than just leasing to the school, and that's where some of the questions come in.
I see that Amtiza is not on this list, and there's been some coverage that they have a nonprofit corporation that bought that building. And I haven't seen the articles of incorporation, but, and maybe this is a question for somebody else at some point, but, you know, what's the difference between an organization that basically is a nonprofit and it's been created specifically to do that charter school, and then we have this affiliated building corporate? I mean, I just, like, you know, pose that. Is it, again, a technicality where, again, we're going back to, we have a nonprofit that's been set up specifically? So can you comment on that, Mr. Hine? Is
yes,
that possible?
Well, the page two is really an update for the committee on the original 29 entities that we had originally identified. If you flip forward to the next page, what I did was I went back through each and every charter school's building documents. And we added a number of entities. I tried to include anyone that appeared to have any kind of affiliation so that we could then go further and scrutinize whether they were, in fact, meeting the definition of an affiliated building corporation. And so you can see TISA would be on this list. And so we have a number of these that are what I would call a gray area. It's not totally clear whether they are or whether they are not. It really kind of depend on what the ultimate definition ended up to be. And then I've listed all of the potential schools on page four. You can see that they meet the ones that we pretty much are clear that they have. Yes, clearly meets the criteria. You can see that they have a lot of these indicators, I guess, that would make it pretty clear. There are a number of them that are in a gray area, and the number of them that are disputing their initial classification.
So, Madam Chair, members, maybe it would help if we take a quick walk through page four and explain what the columns on this mean. I think they're fairly...
That'd be helpful. Thank you, Dr. Melcher.
Fairly self-explanatory. Thank you. So the we have a list here in alphabetical order of these schools and the building corporations, the lessors, and then we've identified whether they are, in fact, a nonprofit. Most of them are. There are a couple that are not nonprofits. Then we've checked to see whether they have common board members, and a number of them do have common, at least one common board member. Also, whether the school was set up, whether the building corporation was set up specifically by the school to renovate or purchase or construct a facility. And you can see toward the bottom of the page, all of them were in that situation, but some of the others above, we either don't have complete information or there's some questions about other activities that they had. A good indicator as to the relatedness is whether they're treated as a component unit in the school's audit. If they're part of the school district's annual audit that's done by CPA firm, that's a pretty solid indicator that they are, in fact, an affiliated corporation. They're considered one unit for purposes of annual financial audits, and you can see toward the bottom of the list all of those are in that situation, but there are some exceptions there. And then the issue, another issue is whether their sole or primary activity is the facility lease or if they're involved in other kinds of operations. And Mr. Hine referred to the Birch Grove example of daycares or other kinds of activities that they might be doing. And so this is where there is some uncertainty in terms of the status. And those that we thought were in something of a gray area are listed at the top of the sheet here, and those that were more clearly affiliated building corporations are at the bottom of the sheet.
Are you aware who the Birch Grove authorizer is? Just, I'm wondering if we could maybe look at that. It's not the Birch Grove Foundation that...
I don't know.
I didn't ask you for that in advance, so we can check on that. So I guess what I'd like to point out, you know, to members is that when you look at the schools with a G, the gray area is, this is, I think, where we've had some questions, and I think the public is looking at this, that if we just address the affiliated building corporations, but again, I think that's why we wanted to look at a broader, how are charter schools financing, what kind of models are out there. I believe it should be our responsibility to ensure transparency and some sort of consistent policy with this. So I guess I'd ask the department as we move forward, and certainly you've been very, very helpful and engaged, you know, so far with us, and we appreciate that, is, you know, where might we go with this so that, again, we don't have a situation where the public says, well, wait a minute, they're doing the exact same thing, getting lease aid. Who owns the building? That would be very helpful if you have some ideas. I know we have talked about a few, but that's, I think, something that I have some questions about. Any other with the gray areas? I think that's where we've seen some of these reports. Mr. Nauman, did you want to add something?
Only, Madam Chair, the answer to your question is Birch Grove is apparently sponsored or authorized by Volunteers of America.
Okay, thank you very much. So,
Madam Chair and Dr. Melcher, is the gray area driven by the looseness of the criteria? We have some that can figure it out or seems to fall in there pretty easy, but there's quite a few that we're not sure. I mean, I don't know the criteria. I mean, you work with it. Do we need to narrow that? Is that where we're headed, maybe?
Madam Chair and Senator Scogin, the language in Subdivision 17A of Minnesota Statutes 124D10 creates a series of requirements for affiliated nonprofit building corporations, but doesn't give an exact definition of what an affiliated nonprofit building corporation is.
We think that was going to be my follow-up. What's the definition? But
we don't have a precise definition there. And so the issue is kind of what extent of affiliation is required before they fall under this provision, and do policymakers want to have some of the same supervision for some of those that are a little bit more loosely affiliated versus more tightly affiliated, I think is the kind of one of the policy questions that's involved here. We know some of these, for example, this Charter Schools Development Corporation is it's more of a nationwide outfit that works with charter schools across the country. So they're not there, it's not really affiliated in the same way as something that was set up for that specific charter school, but maybe performing a lot of the same functions for the school. So is the issue the affiliated nature, or is the issue kind of what you want the charter school to be able to do at different points in the timing of the school's development?
And an excellent question, Senator Scogin, because I think I will ask the department this, but, you know, prior to 2009, was it helpful for us to pass what we did so you could even collect some of this information? Was that helpful to the department? Because the question was we didn't feel we really had access to a lot of this, and so this was really, I think, some placeholder in terms of we need to understand how these schools are operating. What are the boards? Where are they coming from? What are their missions? Some of the information. And that's, I think, where we see the gray area is, do we have access to that? Because I'm imagining that the schools that are in the gray area may not feel they have to provide the information to the department. Are you finding that with the schools that are in this gray area? Are they complying? Mr. Hine?
Well, we were trying to close the loop on the original 29 that were identified, and I worked extensively with them to collect that information. Quite a number of these gray ones we have not even attempted to, at this point, to collect that information, but that would be my plan is for the next step is to inquire about it and try to collect that information so that we can make a better assessment.
If, in fact, we
want to go that route and try to make a more clear determination. That's why there's some questions here, because without having that information, it's hard to
do that.
As part of that additional review, you know, I was looking kind of for any affiliation. Some may be looser, some may be tighter. But I don't know that. I haven't gotten any negative feedback from people that's saying, well, I don't believe that we are, and therefore I'm not going to provide the information.
Very good.
Even the disputers have said, well, we're not really sure we meet the criteria, but you guys figure it out, and if you decide we are, we'll send it in.
So I would hope that if they are contacted, I would hope that they would help us in providing that, because, again, I think that it's helpful for us to be able to follow the money, where it's going, and, again, is there a better way to fund facilities for charter schools? I think if people understand that that's our intent, that would be very helpful. So
if you look at the summary on the front page, is, you know, out of those original 29 that were contacted, we've had, you know, very good compliance with collecting the data. Just virtually, there are a few documents missing for a few entities, and everybody else has fully responded and either have sent all of the stuff in, they're in the disputing area. So we're pretty much there. I would next go to those grays and try to collect the same information so that we can make a better assessment.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Are there any other questions from members? Would you be able to share with us, are there any other pieces within this particular area where we could help, I think, defining affiliated building corporations? Anything else jumping out at this point that we need to maybe look at to clarify within this particular area with the facilities? I mean, understanding better. But, again, we need to develop a comprehensive state policy. And so your help would be really, really appreciated on that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education, one of the things that we run into, a couple things we run into are there was the effective date in the legislation last year, the August 1 effective date. We know that a number of the corporations that were in existence prior to that had some differences from some of the current requirements. So, for example, on the second page the third page of our handout, we have, I'm losing my pages here. Okay, and the second page of our handout, I apologize. We have the piece about proof of ownership. So we have the Aurora School, the Excel Academy, the Laura Jeffrey Academy, St. Paul Conservatory. The information we found out about proof of ownership is that they don't own the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a requirement which we assume is effective for those new corporations that are started. So we haven't gone back retroactively and said you no longer get lease aid because of the – but there are those kinds of issues that we've discovered as a result of this process. Also, with the membership on the boards, if you go back to the – is that the fourth page?
Fourth
page. We have a lot of information about common board members, and we know there's some issues about how does that fit with conflict of interest as it relates to these going forward. So that we're not making a recommendation here, but we're just saying that these are some things that have been identified as a result of this process that the legislature may want to look at and determine kind of how do we deal with this going forward. There seems to be some inconsistencies between current practice and some of the requirements.
So just to clarify what you just said, on under Minnesota Statute 124D.10, line 13 of our handout, which is line 2, we no longer allow an affiliated building corporation to sort of be a pass-through, some might call it laundering money, to go through. Somebody has a private building, and they can lease that directly to the charter school. But you can't have an affiliated building company leasing from a private entity and then leasing back to the charter school, because some could argue that the affiliated building company could be getting the building at a lesser rent and leasing it to the charter school at a higher rent. And there were some suggested examples of that. We did not investigate. We haven't documented those. So what you're saying is that you're not, you at this point, you have not confirmed if they are complying with the new law or if they should. Is that the question, Dr. Melcher? Just trying to.
Madam Chair, I think we've identified that they don't own the building. That's
right.
What we know. The new law says that they don't qualify for lease aid if they don't own the building.
Right.
We've been assuming with our interpretation that that applies to new corporations going forward, that does not apply retroactively to these that were established before the date. Is that
unless the contract's modified.
Unless the contract is modified.
After August 1.
Right. So we're not sure if that was your intent, but that's kind of where we're at right now. We didn't feel that we had the authority to go back and say, well, we found out you don't own the building, the law was changed, therefore we're taking away your lease aid. So that just to make you aware of what the status of the situation is.
You know, on that point, I would like, I think, our staff to look at, because my intent was, I mean, when I, and this is where I think if we need to do some cleanup, is that I don't know why that would be a problem if we were just to say that it applies to all building corporations, because, again, I think we're looking at following the money, and why does it need to go through another organization? Because that is a way, that can be a way for them to develop a fund balance within an affiliated building corporation to be used for other purposes. So that would be something I would like, I think, to, how we would start to address that, at least to be, to be considered. So
we're just raising it as an issue, something.
Absolutely,
that
I appreciate that. So the effective date we need to think about, and to talk if whether or not we can have retroactive policy like that, but that would be helpful. So okay. Any other questions for the department while they are here? Will you be bringing some recommendations to us on this issue regarding the, or should we be working together, or are you going to be submitting some ideas to us we can talk about in advance? Just wanted to check on the process.
Madam Chair, we will be working with you on recommendations.
Very good. We'd really like to see that. That would be great. So thank you very much. Next is Eugene Piccolo from the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Welcome. Thank you for being here today. And I've asked Mr. Piccolo, he has put some things forward, I think, in some viewpoints, editorials, also I think sent to me some suggestions of where we might start in this discussion, and I really appreciate it. I also want to note again that some of the instances that have caused great concern and are very troubling to the public that we have read about are not an indication that every charter school is involved in these kind of situations, that it is not the norm. And I appreciate that the association has voiced concern as well about them and wants to work with us. And so I appreciate Mr. Piccolo being here today. And I think that we've shared in our conversations that, again, is there a better way to do this that addresses accountability? It addresses very, very tight times in terms of our budgets, some oversight. And, again, what's best for kids? I think, you know, within this discussion, we have to think about kids and facilities and making sure that there is equity within that. So, Mr. Piccolo.
Good morning, Senator Saltzman. My name is Eugene Piccolo, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. First, I want to thank Senator Saltzman for the invitation to testify today about charter school facilities. The question about how best to provide for facilities for charter schools has been a source of ongoing discussion since the legislature enacted the charter school law back in 1991. And it's a question that is perplexing and complex in every state of the 39 states in the District of Columbia that have charter school laws. Every state seems to address the question in ways that fit its particular school framework, its educational funding system, and its political culture. But the bottom line question is, to the question is, how best to provide for appropriate, safe, and cost-efficient charter school facilities is a complex issue. It's complex because of a number of factors. First, charter schools are unique organizations in their structural organization. They are school districts, but they do not have a geographic jurisdiction or taxing power, nor the ability to impose levies approved by the legislature for, like example, health and safety, as traditional school districts do. So the method of providing facilities that traditional districts utilize are not available for charter schools. Second, the original charter school law in 1991 stated that charter schools could not purchase land or buildings if they used state funds. It did allow a charter to directly own a building if it was purchased with private funds. While this may be an option, it is pretty much an option that exists only on the paper that it's written on, because nobody's going to give you millions of dollars to build a building or purchase a building. The creation of affiliated building companies, which developed over time, was a way some schools sought to provide an appropriate, safe, stable facility as well as cost-efficient facility for their program. The numbers of these affiliated building companies has grown significantly over the years. As we have seen, it is a way to provide stable facility for the schools. As you know, as long ago as 2003, the legislative auditor recommended the legislature address the issue of affiliated building companies and repeated that recommendation in 2008. The Minnesota Association of Charter Schools worked aggressively this last session to ensure enactment of some rules of the road for these affiliated building companies, because there were no rules of the road. We believe that the measures enacted earlier this year address many of the concerns that have risen over time with regard to these affiliated building companies. The third factor in making this a complex issue is that finding appropriate space to lease for charter schools is very problematic, because charter schools do not normally start up with all their grades in place. They grow grade by grade, year by year, which often means they have to change locations because they can only lease so much space at a time. And that makes it difficult to have a stable environment for the learning to take place. Also, schools have encountered traditional districts which have excess or underutilized buildings who are unwilling to lease to charter schools, and some have even passed policies or put in purchase agreements when they've sold their buildings that the purchaser of the building could not lease the space to a charter school if they wanted to buy the building from the school district. And then the fourth factor in all of this is that the lease aid formula, as it currently exists, provides a negative incentive or perverse incentive, as it gives leverage to landlords and not the charter schools in lease negotiations, since landlords know they can charge rent that maximizes lease aid, and schools have little leverage because there are not an unlimited number of buildings that can be utilized or zoned for school facilities. So charter schools don't have a lot of leverage in negotiating with a lower lease. Given all these factors, it's really somewhat amazing that the hybrid system of leasing affiliated building companies actually works. It's not a perfect system, nor is it a system without challenges, nor is it a system without any aberrations that occur once in a while. But overall, it works. And while it works, there are things that can be perfected, things that can be made less challenging, and things that can be done to correct the system to eliminate the aberrations that occur once in a while. Before sharing some ideas on how to perfect what we've got, it's important to raise a couple fundamental policy questions that the committee may want to consider. Though they may not be able to be answered in the short term because they would require major changes in policy and processes and have significant implications for how we do things as it is. But there are two fundamental questions. Should state policy require charter schools to lease, only lease in the marketplace and eliminate the ownership option in any manner, shape, or form, indirect through affiliated building companies or through direct ownership? If this were to be state policy, there are a number of questions that need to be considered, including what do we do with affiliated building companies that exist, and how do we put incentives in the system to ensure leasing is done in the most cost-effective way? Second fundamental question is, should the state policy allow charters to directly own buildings and use state funding to purchase or build those facilities? If direct ownership were the policy, there are numerous questions and issues again, including the level of risk the state wants to take on. Because if a charter school closes and the bonds and the mortgage aren't paid off, then the state would be responsible for those liabilities. How would the state provide funding to charter schools to purchase, renovate, or construct buildings? What's the best method? And we can see by looking at other states, there's all kinds of ways states are doing this. Answering those fundamental questions may take more than this legislative session to figure out, especially given that there are expected to be hundreds of vacant school buildings in traditional districts over the next few years and the current financial situation of the state. Nevertheless, there are things we believe that could be done this next year. And I've passed you have a sheet that has some suggestions. In terms of accountability, one is to subject affiliated building companies to the open meeting law. One of the provisions that was put in place this year was that they are required to meet the data practices law, but there is not a provision about the open meeting law. That would give more transparency to the meetings of those boards of affiliated building companies. Second would be to prohibit affiliated building company board members, charter school board members, charter school employees from receiving any remuneration in conjunction with the sale of bonds or their financial transactions related to affiliated billing companies. We've seen that has been a headline in one of the stories, and we believe that should be just made clear that people cannot be getting money off of the fact that bonds were sold. Third, prohibit affiliated billing board companies from being employed or contracting to provide any service or sell products to the affiliated billing company. Again, it's a matter of conflict of interest that we need to be clarified. In terms of public asset protection, we believe that the state should establish a policy that fully paid for facilities owned by affiliated billing company become the asset of the state upon the closure of an affiliated charter school. So if a charter school has an affiliated billing company, the bonds are paid off and the school closes because people don't want the program anymore, that asset of that billing company also becomes an asset of the state. The assets of the school become the assets of the state under when a school closes, but we're suggesting that if the building's paid off, that asset also comes to the state. Prohibit school districts from establishing or implementing policies or practices that discriminate against charter schools as potential lease tenants of excess or underutilized district facilities. It does not make sense, these are all public schools, to have other government agencies saying to other government agencies they cannot lease space in their underutilized or empty buildings. Third, we would propose to commission the legislative auditor to conduct a study of current school facility capacity in the state, future needs of all public schools, districts, and charters, and how to effectively utilize all these public facilities. In terms of lease aid, we have two recommendations. Retitle lease aid to facilities aid and then restructure facilities aid so that it can be utilized for any facility-related cost, including meeting health and safety requirements, maintenance, and utilities. This would put in place an incentive for schools to get a lower lease cost because then they could use some of those funds for other purposes and not have to take general funds for maintenance and facilities. And in a way, it's a way of putting more money in the classroom without increasing the cost of the state. It would give a real incentive, I think, to try to get at the best least cost for schools. And then finally, eliminate the annual review of multi-year contracts by MDE. A school normally leases for 5 years, and MDE reviews the lease every year, even though it's after the fact, and it's just a redundancy that doesn't seem to make any sense for anybody. So those are some recommendations to begin with.
Very good. Are there questions from the committee? You'd be thinking about that. I want to thank you. This is a great start. I think that this is the beginning of where we're seeing some recommendations. And I do want to clarify that in terms of, again, charter schools can own buildings now. The technical piece is that they can't use state money to buy. So that is the question here of, are we going around that? I do want to also note that I appreciate, Mr. Piccolo, that you have noted in some of your writings that some of the things that have happened technically are legal, but the issue is that why are we having to look at tightening up conflict of interest laws is because people have questioned they may be legal, but were they right? And that's, I think, I appreciate that you have made a strong statement on that we sometimes have to create laws when people find loopholes and ways around them. So I do appreciate that you've made a strong statement on that. I do want to ask within health and safety that if we were to retitle Lease A to Facility Aid and expand it, because right now some of the things you mentioned are specifically mentioned as not being able to be covered, but when you talk about complying with health and safety requirements, charter schools right now are exempt from some of those?
No, under the law this year, there was a change in the law that said charter schools must meet all federal, that was added, federal, okay, in addition to local and state health and safety requirements. So we added requirements
Very
this
good.
Year to charter schools that they meet also federal health and safety requirements.
Very good. That is good. I just wanted
Madam
to
Chair?
Note that. And Senator Olson.
But Madam Chair, if it's, we better be careful because our use of health and safety revenue is a rather expansive list.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you might not want to saddle the charter schools with some of the things we put in that for the regular schools.
Madam Chair, but they are saddled with that because the law says they must meet all federal health and safety requirements.
But Madam Chair, Mr. Piccolo, does the constitution of the use of aid, does that make it a requirement? We know that there are health and safety provisions in statute and code and that type of thing. But I think our use of that revenue has gone beyond some of those kinds of uses. I think we just need to look at that.
Okay, just we'll just
if I'm
note.
If I'm wrong, fine. But just be sure that we're on target.
Well, that's a good point, Senator Olson, is that I think some of the things we're talking about is let's check on that. So, I mean, we put a lot of stuff on the table today, but I appreciate that we're looking at what are the pros and cons of doing those, you know, some of those things. So, and then the other thing I think, you know, to think about here is that we talk about that once facilities are you know, once they are paid for at some point in time, what do they revert back? Is there a different formula for lease aid? And I think we go again here is, what happens if the bonds are not paid off, if a school closes, defaults on something? How do we work with that? Because I think, Senator Olson, you had mentioned, you know, at our last meeting, we've invested all this money, and then it technically goes to the bondholders who could sell it off or something like that. And also, Mr. Piccolo, I do appreciate that. I think I've mentioned that we probably have about a pretty stable number of kids in the state over the next 5 to 10 years. And our facilities right now, some of them need improvements, but we have enough buildings right now. And if kids are moving between a charter school or a charter to a district school, and then we're putting, is it $84 million per biennium, I think, Mr. Nauman? Are we putting $84 million per biennium into charter school lease aid? Is it around?
Madam
Mr.
Chair, I can give you the most recent.
I should give you more time before I ask
this question. I think that's pretty close to the right number based on, and of course this is a shifted item, so it's going to be somewhat distorted, but under the most recent forecast, it's about, sorry, I had the wrong.
And I'm sorry, I didn't give you
I have it
notice.
Right here.
We don't have everything memorized up here.
Well, it's the correct magnitude. It's about $81.2 million under the current forecast, and of course that's slightly depressed because of the shift effect. But yeah, that'd be about the right order.
So, if those kids were in our district schools, we wouldn't be spending $40 million on lease aid. And so, if a child moves to a charter school, we then have to start paying lease aid for facilities. When do we have? Do we have facilities, and how do we, again, work together? Are you familiar, Mr. Piccolo, on some of the other state policies with facilities? Because if we could have some help with that, or are there models in other state? It looks like you have something right there at the
yes.
table. And I know Chicago because we've looked at them because they are often referenced by, you know, the president and Secretary Duncan. And we've looked at some of their language regarding facilities. Some states don't have a separate fund for facilities, and we've been suggested that we have a very good policy. That's because we have the policy that probably puts the most money into lease aid. Could you, I guess, just comment on other states?
Senator Saltzman, committee members, yes. Every state does it significantly different. For example, Alaska says that schools may operate in a vacant school facility building or other facility that the local superintendent deems appropriate. Some states, like Arizona, say that schools can own buildings directly, but then they can also bond through what's called the Industrial Development Authority of the state, so they can get direct bonds from the state. Other states have, like Colorado, have created something called the Cultural and Education Facilities Authority, which issues bonds not only for schools but other cultural organizations and so forth, and charter schools can get it through that. Some states give a grant to schools when they start to be able to buy a facility. So there's all kinds of different ways in which there's about 35 different ways that states are doing this, but I'd be happy to get this information to the committee members.
That would be helpful. There's one more question I just wanted to ask is that I think we talk about competition, that when a school district has to build a building, we had some excellent testimony on what a district goes through in terms of selling it to the public and really asking the public, are you willing to pay this much for this building? And then we look at lease aid that a district has and trying to get the most competitive bid. Do you think the fact that if you have a building and a charter school wants to lease it, and as the person who is going to lease it, I know how much money you have access to. It's approximately $1,200, per student. Do you think that allows for a competitive bidding process?
Senator Saltzman, I think that's one of the reasons we have the recommendation is to change lease aid to facilities aid so that schools do have some leverage, because basically the leverage right now is with the landlords. Everybody knows the game is maximize the lease aid, and schools are really are kind of captive because they need a space to operate. And so the landlord says, well, if you don't want to pay this, you don't get it. And so there is no incentive right now to keep lease costs down, especially in a commercial market where the indications are it's going to collapse in the next year. I think there needs to be incentive in state policy to give leverage to the charter schools in those negotiations.
Okay. Are there some questions for Mr. Piccolo? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent, good discussion, and we look forward to being engaged with you. So at this time, members, I know if you're prepared to, but would you like to share some of the areas that I think we want to tackle? And I think I sent out to you an email and suggested one of the things I think we have a question before us is, may charter schools own buildings that are paid for with state dollars? That seems to be a question. If people want to have any other comments on where else do you think we might wade in this issue? What particular areas this session might you like to look at? And Senator Olson, you look like you're about to put your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I'd raised that issue before in terms of the ultimate ownership because of the state investment, but I think I had not thought about what Mr. Piccolo raised, that if they go into default before the building is paid off in our obligation, I think we really need to think about that. But I'd also like, I think we need to hash through the issue of accessibility to school buildings that have already been paid for by the taxpayer, and how that can be how that can be handled. It may not just be, you know, automatic accessibility, but perhaps there's some of that lease payments can go that can bring some relief to the taxpayer, property taxpayers that paid off those buildings. I mean, there, I think there could be a way that could build a cooperative and a better spirit in, rather than a resentment of the school seeing it as an opportunity. I don't know. I'm just talking
I appreciate
off the
that.
Top of my head. But I think we do need to address that, because if we're going to have a lot of vacant buildings out there, there's something that just doesn't smack as being right about that in terms of our use of taxpayers' investments.
And a question from Senator Rummel.
You know, this is probably what makes this all so difficult, because regular schools are operating in many times with funds that are growing leaner and leaner every year, and so in order to save taxpayers' money, they can consolidate, which creates the empty buildings, and then parents possibly who are unhappy with that reverse the efficiencies that regular school districts are under and form a charter school and use the very buildings. So we get in this, it's kind of, we're really in a bind, and I don't know how we resolve that. The cost of educating our kids, and I was very appreciative of Mr. Piccolo's reference to the word capacity. I don't think it's just building capacity. I think it's the capacity of a community to support a certain number of schools that we need to talk about.
There, that is a great point, Senator Rummel, because I do think that when we're looking at this, we are thinking about kids, but we are urging people to make cost-effective decisions. And is there, when you do that, I think that's been the argument that we have brought up, and we've talked about using existing buildings. Is a charter school going in because parents don't want their local school closed? And that's an important, and that's the gray area in this discussion that we have struggled with. So how do we, again, as we look at other states, we also see greater cooperation between charter schools and district schools. What happened in Minnesota that we do seem to have this resentment, I think, as Senator Olson said, is how do we, they're all of our district schools and how, they're all of our public schools, but they are funded with public dollars, and how do we make sure that we use those dollars, especially in these times, as efficiently as possible? So, Senator Olson?
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, all of this has started, whether it was charter schools or other issues of choice, to be responsive to educational needs of students and how parents perceive those. And I think there was still an underlying sense that with more choices and competition, public schools may respond. Now, maybe we've tied their hands too much, and we ought to look at how we can release that. But our regular system responding to what those parents' needs are often keeps them in place. And I can, you know, I've seen some schools and school districts that have, in fact, done that and done that very well, and there hasn't been the propensity to move to charter schools. And in some cases, many of them are winning back, not for just financial reasons, but for the quality of their program, for private schools, and have goals. They set goals as to what they're attempting to do that to keep stability in their student population. So there's, you know, that it's more than just, I think, location. I think for many families, it's trying to assure that they're being responsive to their, you know, their children's needs. You and I know that. We've been working on it with the literacy issue. Mm-hmm. And the challenge of that, if it's not being addressed, how we can keep kids from being hostage to that, and yet we want schools to respond and deliver what we know and what research tells us can be done. So I think it's all of this is wrapped up together, and it's pretty hard to kind of pick out one little piece of it and say that, you know, that we want to lock in a policy that might get in the way of some other kinds of response too. I don't think we want to take away the good things and the choices there that the charter schools have brought. We want them to function well, but by the same token, I think we'd also like our regular system to recognize if they don't want people leaving, you know, there are ways to do that, and hopefully that those can be addressed as well.
I'd like to throw out a couple things that I think we'll cover at our next meeting, and then if you have some other ideas, I would like to hear from the department with the financing costs so we get an idea. I think that will help us. Is that maybe possible, Mr. Hine, by first or second week of January? Do you think we might be able to, or when might you be able, do you think, have some of that information? That may be the better question. And this is the information to just sort of look at, you know, when bonds are sold, what's the cost of the building versus the long-term financing cost?
Well, what I've done, Madam Chair and committee, is contact all of the bond agencies who likely would have been involved in these transactions and ask them specifically for a number of pieces of information, the goal being kind of figuring out what the interest rate and the fees mm-hmm. are on these issues. Also ask for comparable information from a general obligation issue from a regular public Excellent. School district in a close proximity so that we can get some comparing and contrasting. I would hope that they would respond, and I'll continue to follow up with them, but I'm kind of at their mercy. I have requested all the information. Ball's kind of in their court now as to when they get it back to me.
Do you think you're getting what you need? I mean, so we haven't heard back yet, but do you think, since these were sold through municipalities, this is where I'm in the gray area here, is that public information?
Yeah.
So we should be able to get it. It's just a matter of how quickly people may be able to provide us with the information you've requested.
We could go back to the original issuer and request that.
Okay. Whatever we can do to help you, urge people to help us understand this issue, we'd be happy to do that.
We're a bit hamstrung on that front because we don't necessarily know whether those transactions have taken place or not. If they're not disclosed within the lease agreement, which many times they're not, it's very difficult for us to tell where the origin of that funding came from.
That's another interesting sort of twist on this is where did the original funding come from? And that's so I think as much as you can give us, I think would be helpful.
We could contact the known and possible schools with affiliated building corporations and just flat out ask, hey, how did you fund it?
Right. Whatever.
That'd be another possibility.
That would maybe be helpful. I mean, if that would be something, and maybe Mr. Piccolo, if you can get a message out to your members, it would be helpful. They don't have to provide that, but if they would, that would be helpful. And again, it's to be able to look at, is there a better way? Mr. Piccolo?
Senator Saltzman, I think given that the law now is in effect that data from these affiliated billing companies is public data, mm-hmm. that could be requested under the public data requirements mm-hmm. of the law because they should have all that information since they're the ones assigned for those bonds.
Very good. Excellent point. Okay, so we will look at that. Thank you very much. That is helpful. So we will look at that. I'd also like to ask some of the other organizations if there's other legislative solutions you might like to put on the table to be prepared to, you know, provide us with what we've heard from Max today, the association. If there's some other suggestions out there, that would be very helpful, I think, to start looking at any other things that members would like us a little bit more background on in terms of this issue.
Madam Chair, are we going to start down the road of, in this committee, of the definitions mm-hmm. that seem to, there may be a need to tighten up some definitions intent of previous legislation, or are we saving that for the full committee, or do we want to start that conversation next time we get together?
I believe that our charge is that we are to bring something back to the Education Committee, the full Education Committee, in terms of recommendations. Is it an actual bill, or will it lead to a bill before session starts? I mean, I think Senator Sumpf would like that on the table on February 4th, something from this committee. And it may be we've started the process, here are the questions we have, we need to do more work on it. But in terms of this session, if we're going to be doing anything and passing anything, we need to have it pretty much ready to go so that we can have that discussion within the full Education Committee. If we need to, I have not talked with him about having, a subcommittee meeting after session starts. And as Mr. Piccolo has pointed out, there may be some things that we do that are short term while we look at something longer term. So I would like to see this. So if there, and that requires, I think, some work between committee meetings. Of if you have ideas or you want to work with staff, I would encourage all of you to do that. If you have suggestions or things that you'd like to start looking at, that would be great. So, very good. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify today? We have just about 10 minutes left. If anybody else is here. Oh, Senator, excuse me, Senator Rumble.
We don't have to use the 10 minutes.
No, we don't have to use the 10 minutes, but if anybody is here and has a pressing need to come up, because I know we've not really asked for public testimony, but if anyone here has anything, I know some of the charter schools have contacted me, I think have sent letters. So if we're done, that would be even better. So anyone, just let me know. I don't see anyone coming forward, so with that, meeting adjourned, and I will be contacting you at future date. Senator Olson, before I...
I was just saying, have you any proposed future times, or will we get some advance notice of those?
Yes. In terms of future times, I will send out looking at... I felt that we needed to get this moving in December, and so we put some dates out, but I will be contacting... I'm thinking about that first week in January, and then I've been called to jury duty on July 19th. So,
July?
Excuse me.
January
19th. So I'm kind of wondering about scheduling meetings that week. But it would make sense to do something like the first week and then the third week of January. But I'll work because I know, again, we're not in session yet and trying to work with people's schedules. So thank you very much. And meeting adjourned.